From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. The new film Angels and Insects is set in Victorian England, but it's not a quaint costume drama of mores and morality. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with film director Philip Haas about his unsettling new film based on a novella by A.S. Byatt and about directing ants, moths, and butterflies along with the actors. Also, we meet Ramblin' Jack Elliott. He's been traveling and singing for almost 40 years. Woody Guthrie was his mentor. Elliott has his first studio album in over 20 years. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews Keyboard Wizards of the Gershwin Era. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. British Prime Minister John Major and Irish leader John Bruton today announced a date for the start of negotiations in Northern Ireland. The talks are set for June 10th, following elections in Northern Ireland for the so-called Peace Assembly. The IRA and its supporters had demanded a firm date for negotiations as the only way to restore the ceasefire broken earlier this month. Both Major and Bruton denied the resumption of violence spurred them to act. A Palestinian security official today said all Palestinians who have unlicensed guns must turn them into police by Saturday. He said after that, Palestinian police will begin conducting house-to-house searches for the guns. From Jerusalem, Linda Gradstein reports.
Brigadier Ghazi Jabali, the head of the Palestinian police, also said that PLO leader Yasser Arafat has ordered the immediate court-martial of two senior police officers who participated in a rally supporting the extremist Hamas group. The announcements seem to show that PLO is beginning to comply with Israeli demands of Arafat in the wake of Sunday's suicide bombings that killed 25 people. Jabali said whoever is found with an unlicensed gun will be punished. Meanwhile, the Hamas movement said that an Arab American who drove a rented car into a Jerusalem bus stop Monday and killed one Israeli was a member of Hamas's military wing. Hamas said it was in retaliation for Israel's alleged assassination of Islamic Jihad leader Fatih Shkaki in Malta last year. For National Public Radio, I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
The U.S. Attorney's Office in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, has announced a U.S. Fish and Wildlife officer has been indicted for lying to the FBI. Ed Ark of member station WITF reports that his actions may have helped terrorists in the World Trade Center bombing.
42-year-old Kelvin Smith of New Bloomfield in central Pennsylvania is named in the indictment returned by a federal grand jury sitting in Harrisburg. The document alleges Smith lied to the FBI about the nature and extent of paramilitary training that Smith provided a group of individuals then under FBI investigation for suspected terroristic activities. Four members of the group trained by Smith and one of their leaders were indicted in New York in 1993 and convicted late last year of conspiracy to commit acts of urban terrorism, including the bombing of the World Trade Center in New York. Smith has been on administrative leave from his job as a special agent with the Fish and Wildlife Service in Harrisburg since September of 1994. If convicted, he could face 20 years in prison and be fined $1 million. For National Public Radio, I'm Ed Ark reporting.
Two leading Republican activists today attacked Patrick Buchanan's strident anti-immigrant rhetoric, saying his campaign language has led to an ugly antipathy toward all immigrants. Jack Kemp and William Bennett say they sponsored a study on immigration by their conservative Empower America think tank to correct the anti-immigrant sentiments now dominating the public debate. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up almost 17 points. You're listening to National Public Radio News. The House has begun debate on a bill that would change the nation's agricultural policy. NPR's Chitra Raghavan has more.
The bill would eliminate the traditional payments or subsidies that farmers now receive when market prices fall below a preset government target price. The bill under consideration would give farmers fixed payments for 7 years, gradually lowering that amount to wean farmers off government. Proponents of the legislation say this would give farmers greater flexibility to plant the crops they want and to react to market demands. But opponents say the bill would eliminate a vital safety net for farmers and turn subsidies into welfare payments. Many economists say consumers are unlikely to be affected by changes in wheat, corn, rice, and cotton programs because they mostly affect farmers' incomes. But some members of Congress, consumer groups, and ice cream, candy, and soft drink manufacturers are calling for reform of sugar and peanut programs, saying reform would lower consumer costs. I'm Chitra Raghavan in Washington.
President Clinton has asked Congress to amend the bill outlawing one kind of late-term abortion. The president says lawmakers should allow the procedure when life or health of a woman is at risk. Consumer prices took a big jump in January, increasing 0.4%. The Labor Department says that an increase in energy prices was instrumental in pushing prices sharply higher. It's the biggest one-month gain in more than 2 years. In another report, the Commerce Department says the U.S. trade deficit in goods and services widened in December and hit a 7-year high for all of 1995. The trade gap in December rose 1% to $6.78 billion. For the year, the gap rose 4.5% to $111 billion, the biggest shortfall since 1988. The International Narcotics Control Board has added its voice to those expressing concern over the growing use of Ritalin for young children diagnosed as hyperactive. The group says the drug is being overprescribed. I'm Frank Stachow, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen, in for Terry Gross. When filmmaker Philip Haas read A.S. Byatt's 1992 novella Morpho Eugenia, he knew immediately that it had cinematic possibilities. Set in Victorian England, it's the story of William Adamson, a naturalist who has spent many years doing research in the Amazon. On his way back to England, he is shipwrecked and loses almost all his specimens. One of his sponsors, Harold Alabaster, an amateur insect collector, invites him to live on his estate. Adamson is immediately entranced by Alabaster's daughter, Eugenia, whom he marries. But all is not what it seems in the Alabaster family. There are dark secrets beneath the outward civility, which are slowly revealed to Adamson. Philip Haas began his film career making documentaries about artists such as David Hockney, Richard Long, and Gilbert and George. He's collaborated with his wife, Belinda Haas, on documentaries and on their other feature film, The Music of Chance. Here's a scene from the beginning of Angels and Insects, when Adamson, played by Mark Rylance, has his first naive encounter with Eugenia Alabaster, played by Patsy Kensit, at a ball.
My father was so sorry to hear you had lost so much in the terrible shipwreck. For your sake, and for his own, he was eager to add to his collection.
Well, I did manage to save one or two of the rarest, most beautiful butterflies. I suppose there's a certain pathos in saving a dead butterfly. But one in particular is such a rarity. I say no more now, but I believe your father will be glad to have it. And you too. But it's to be a surprise, really.
I hate people who tell me I am to have a surprise and will not tell me what it is.
You don't like suspense?
No. No, I don't. I am afraid of surprises.
I must remember never to surprise you then.
What interested you about the story?
I was very much attracted to the visual possibilities in the story. The idea of comparing a Victorian house to an ant colony and certain other visual things in the film or in the story were very attractive. The idea of our hero, William Adamson, wooing his bride by creating a cloud of butterflies to encircle her in the conservatory seemed to me that if we could pull it off in a film, would be a magical moment. Also, it had a very compelling storyline, and the denouement at the end seemed to me totally shocking. I mean, when I read it, I was felt like I'd been hit in the stomach, and I wanted to reproduce that in film. So it was really a combination of it being a visually exciting piece, a very dramatic one, and one that made me think about the story for a long time after I read it. And what I try and do in a film is to at once engage an audience and then hopefully let them not forget it.
Well, this is certainly another kind of view of Victorian life. This is not straight-laced and pure. Were you interested in really delving under and beneath and around the kind of structure of that society, the outward structure of that society?
Yes, very much. I mean, what appealed to me in the Byatt novella is that A.S. Byatt, or Antonia Byatt, is a contemporary writer. So she's looking at the 19th century through the lens of the 20th century, and that excited me enormously. I wanted to look at the Victorians in the same way that they were looking at the insects, and I didn't want to make a conventional costume piece. You know, I wanted to take it outside the museum and to, you know, bring our own point of view to a period which I think had been sort of glossed over and prettified in a lot of earlier films. I mean, this was sort of the film was almost made in opposition to the BBC type of costume drama that one has seen of late.
Well, I think it's certainly clear that this does not have the kind of historical correctness that you see in those kinds of BBC films where costumes and artifacts and hairstyles are perfect. I mean, they're right out of a museum. You play with a kind of surrealistic look.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say that they're historically inaccurate. I mean, everything is based on history. It's just slightly skewered. So, for example, the hairstyle of the young girls in the film, we got out of photographs of hairstyles of dead Victorian children. I found the story quite sinister and perverse, and I wanted to accentuate that visually. So we did it by looking into the Victorian period and then taking what we found and slightly altering it.
Describe those hairstyles for us.
With the children, for example, it's just very, very severe and mannered with little sort of odd curls masquerading for bangs. One of the things that we did with Eugenia, played by Patsy Kensit, is almost make her hair feel alive so that as she gets fatter, it starts suffocating her. So the hair was as much a visual indication of what was going on in the story as the costumes.
Well, certainly the costumes are quite arresting. These are shimmering, bold colors. Working with your costume designer, what were you looking to tell, explore?
Well, one of the things that seemed to me very interesting was to make this parallel between the insect world and the human world. So we wanted the costumes to comment on the insect-like qualities of the characters. At the same time, researching the period costume-wise, one saw that the Victorians did have very strong dyes, and they were forever, you know, sewing sort of dead beetles onto their shawls. So we took all of this and then slightly altered it, slightly heightened it. I wanted it to have a kind of Alice through the Looking Glass feel. For example, with the small children who wore crinolines, you know, the undergarments to make their dresses blossom out. I just had the costume designer make them larger. So again, it's slightly, the scale is somewhat exaggerated. So you have this sinister feeling. I found the story very disturbing, and I wanted to disturb the audience visually, too.
Well, I noticed, too, with shapes and with stripes as well, that the stripes both enhanced the costumes and the dresses that people wore, but also constricted them at the same time. There was this interesting tension going on, even within the costumes.
Yes, I mean, this is a film about contradiction, you know, whether it's angels and insects or black and white or Victorian, you know, morality and sexuality. And, of course, you know, the Victorians were obsessed with sex, even though one tends to think of it as a sort of a contradiction in terms, Victorian sexuality. And one of the ways to show this kind of contradiction is you have these very constricting costumes and then very bold graphic sexual scenes as well. I think one of the things that's quite interesting in this piece, which deals with sexuality, is, as I've remarked, in a very graphic way, is that it's not gratuitous because it is a film about ourselves as reproductive animals, as breeding machines. And it was important to, you know, make the sexuality come across in a very bold way and almost a sort of scientific way.
I'm interested, too, in how you approach the scenes where people were having sex. And I assume there are many traps that a filmmaker can fall into in trying to put sex on the scene. Going into them or even conceiving them, what were your thoughts?
Well, firstly, I wanted to make it visually interesting. That is, not to feel like sexual scenes that one has seen before. I mean, generally, in a movie, you'll see, you know, a man and a woman in a shower, you know,
right.
And it looks like a sort of an ad for soap, you know, with a bit of sort of Playboy magazine thrown in. What we had going for us here is the sexuality was very much a part of the story, so the actors didn't feel exploited in any way, And, you know, they all wanted it to feel true to the story. And although this is not a pornographic movie, you know, we wanted their response to feel like a response that, you know, a couple would have behind closed doors.
I noticed many of those scenes were filmed through a kind of gauzy a curtain that tangs around Eugenia's bed.
Well, one of the things that we did in the, I think it's in one scene in particular that you get this sort of shot through the gauze effect, and it's on their wedding night. One, the gauze gave it a kind of soft, romantic feel, and then it was punctuated with shots inside the gauze, which were much more graphic and harsh. And I wanted to play on that, these two things of romance and softness coupled by, you know, sexual rigor. And one of the things that's surprising in the story is this virginal character played by Patsy Kensit. Eugenia seems to, you know, have an enormous appetite for sex, and that obviously becomes part of the story as the film progresses.
Her bedroom too looks like some kind of a I'm not sure, some kind of a lair. I mean, it's an interestingly...
Yes, it's a kind of spider's web, isn't it, really? You know, it's a film about entrapment, and the bedroom is a sort of metaphor for that. Also, you know, it's a film, you know, in which the sexuality is equally explicit with men and women. You know, you generally, you know, in films which are dealing with sex, you know, in a sophisticated... shall I say, artistic way. You know, the director has no problem with sort of revealing all of the woman, and the man is sort of, you know, viewed as a sort of just the, you know, upper torso. And in fact, you know, here, you know, everybody is shown with their trousers off, as it were.
Well, let me just ask you something, because this was a very graphic scene in the film where, again, without giving too much away, one of the men is shown with a slight erection, and it gave the film a kind of reality to it. And I don't know if that was something that you felt comfortable with, the actor felt comfortable with, or not.
I mean, I wouldn't say that it was planned, but you know, the event occurred, and it made the scene more shocking. It's meant to be a very shocking scene, and you know, the actor was okay about it, and. You know, we're not sort of advertising this is the first time in a sort, you know, in a nationally released art movie that this is seen, but, you know, it probably is. And if I think it definitely enhances the story.
My guest is filmmaker Philip Haas. His new film is Angels and Insects. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is film director Philip Haas, and his latest film is called Angels and Insects. I want to ask you about a couple of scenes where we see the naturalist William Adamson. He has married Eugenia Alabaster, lives at the Alabaster Estate, and there are several scenes where we see him walking down the hall, and coming towards him are a couple of female servants, a couple of maids. And as they pass, they turn themselves and face the wall. I didn't know if this was a common custom at that time or whether this was something that you invented, but it makes for an interesting, powerful interchange as these people pass in these darkened hallways.
I got the idea because in researching the period, I read that a particularly nasty lord fired any servant who dared to cross his path. So I felt that the servants in this house would have been terrified that if they had any contact with the gentry, you know, their position might be threatened, or they would be, you know, dismissed. So although William isn't quite of the gentry, they view him as, you know, he's now married to, you know, to Eugenia. So they just would not want to make eye contact with him. Similarly, since we are making this analogy between the worker ants and the servants, you can never really tell what the face of an ant looks like. So I didn't want you to be able to see the servants' faces, with exception of the servant, you know, Amy, who becomes important in the story.
So, and in a sense, it's true. Their faces are kind of covered, and we see them. They're small, and they kind of flitter by.
Right. And in fact, in casting the servants, we cast all local people. I wanted them to be really of the place, and we were very specific in our advertisements of saying, looking for small, dark people to play this, you know, these parts in a film.
What's the challenge of working with insects, specifically in this film, butterflies, moths, ants? As a film director, who's in charge? The animals or you?
No, I would say the animals definitely were in charge. There's an old adage: never work on a film with children or animals. And you know, animals generally is referred to as sort of barnyard animals. I now have to extend that to never work with insects. It was extremely difficult. I mean, each species presented a different challenge. You know, from the butterflies to the moths to the ants. I mean, for example, with the ants, we have a number of scenes in which a colony of red slave-making ants attack a colony of your sort of normal black ants. Unfortunately, where we were shooting the film in Warwickshire in England, the red slave-making ants don't exist. So we actually had to transport a log from southern England full of a red slave-making colony up at the dead of night, so that when they woke up in the morning, they wouldn't know they had moved. We had to position in the exact same position to the sun as they were in the south of England. And they quickly adapted to their new locale. But after a couple of days, a vicious woodpecker started attacking them. So they decamped. So we had to then try and gather up the ones that had decamped and then bring another log in. So that was just one challenge. With the butterflies, it became a question of how many butterflies would one have to release to create a cloud of butterflies. And then when we figured out that it would be in the thousands, to actually get, you know, 4,000 butterflies became an enormous task. We ended up renting them from the Stratford-upon-Avon butterfly farm.
How do you do that?
Well, you go and speak to the owner and say, look, we will rent them at 50 cents a butterfly and return them to you. And we found that the butterflies really flew well for only one launch. So it meant figuring out a system of transporting them the 45 miles from the butterfly farm to the estate, then releasing them, collecting them, and sending them back to Stratford so they could replenish themselves. And basically we had a whole kind of carpool system of always having, you know, several thousand butterflies at hand, and then recirculating them after they had rested and fed. With the moths, it just was very hard to get them to actually attack the actress. We finally sort of did it by a combination of positioning them, throwing them at her. But Patsy Kensett, who plays the actress at once sort of attracted to the butterflies and repelled by the moths, was a wonderful sport, particularly since she hated the moths. They're awful, the ones we use, these hawk moths. I mean, awful in the sense that they're rather menacing looking and sort of dropped on her unexpectedly and made terrible noises. So she didn't have a whole lot of acting that was necessary. I mean, she found it very repellent and showed that enormously and easily. And I think the scene, you know, works splendidly because of that.
Yeah, and what we see are the moths really climbing up her dress, and she's terrified, of course. In the scene where the butterflies are launched as a sort of a great seduction, what were the specifics of launching those butterflies? What specifically did you have to do to get them to do what you wanted on film?
Well, one, it needed to look like they were encircling her and not just being dumped on her. So it was a question of positioning them with relationship to the camera and to Patsy. And we launched them with 10 people with butterfly nets out of camera sight, releasing them in the directions that we determined would give a feeling of them flying around her in a way that was natural and not looking like we're just shooting butterflies out of a cannon.
And that then created the kind of swirly
yes.
look that we see. Did you work with entomologists, with bug wranglers, I mean, scientists who know how to at least try to make these insects do something?
Well, we had an entomologist from Oxford University who sort of advised us really on animal behavior. And then some of the second unit photography, that is the close-ups of the ant raids, basically with all the ant close-up photography was done by a couple of BBC documentary filmmakers. Mm-hmm. But by and large, the staging, you know, the first unit, that is myself and Belinda, who edited the film, my wife, in addition to writing it with me, we sort of staged and figured out how to deal with the insects. What is interesting from an entomological point of view is when the film was finished, we sent a cassette to E.O. Wilson, the Harvard professor who's probably the world's foremost authority on ants.
Absolutely.
And sociobiology.
Yeah.
And he loved the film and said he particularly admired its sweet menace and at the same time found it very compelling because it was entomologically accurate. So we got the certification from Professor Wilson.
You must be pleased.
Yes, I mean, you know, it would have been terrible to sort of done it and then pointed out that it was wrong.
You began your film career by making documentaries. What got you interested in films in the first place?
I wasn't a sort of cineast like a director, say, such as Tarantino, who's probably seen every film ever made. You know, I went to the movies like most people go to the movies, but I was very much interested in the theater. And at university, I was a theater director and worked in the theater after leaving university for a couple of years. So I think the story element of films, the narrative, the dramatic side of things always interested me. And then I had met some artists socially in England and became intrigued with the idea of doing documentary films with them. And out of that, I spent 10 years making documentary films, always with artists. Interesting people like David Hockney and Gilbert and George, to Australian Aboriginal artists. But in my own mind, I always viewed myself not as a documentary filmmaker, but as a filmmaker, somebody telling a story. In these instances, you know, a story about a visual person making a work of art. So I kind of view both the documentary work and the feature work as a whole, as all a part of the work that I've been doing these past dozen years.
So what's the next feature film you're working on?
It's a film called Exquisite Corpse. It's set in London and Paris in the 30s, very dark comedy about a vanishing lady and a young surrealist artist's obsessional search for her. So it's about a group of imaginary British surrealists. There are a few real surrealists in it, like Salvador Dali, and it will be a film that is visually very extreme.
Based on
a book by Robert Irwin, a very good English novelist. And we're going to shoot that this summer for 20th Century Fox.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Well, I enjoyed speaking with you enormously.
Director Philip Haas's new film is Angels and Insects. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Folk singer Ramblin' Jack Elliott has hitchhiked cross-country, competed in rodeos, toured with Woody Guthrie, and influenced a young Bob Dylan. Coming up, we'll meet him.
Bedbugs is mean and evil, they sure don't mean me no good. Bedbugs is mean and evil, they sure don't mean me no good. Hey, there's a woodpecker and I'm a chunk of wood. heard a noise in the corner. I went in to see. I heard a noise in the corner. I went in to see.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Alaskan writer Sheila Nickerson opens her new book with this announcement. I live in a place where people disappear. Alaska, too large to comprehend. Her book, Disappearance, a Map, nonetheless tries to comprehend the disappearances in the form of death, change, and loss that have marked her life. Book critic Maureen Carrigan has a review.
In the spring of 1992, a few months before Sheila Nickerson planned to retire from her editing job at a conservation magazine, a colleague of hers disappeared. Kent Roth was flying back from a fishing weekend when his Cessna vanished into the immense blankness of snow and glaciers that's known as Alaska's Bermuda Triangle. This same territory, nearly 20 years before, swallowed up House Democratic leader Hale Boggs and Alaska Congressman Nick Begich. For weeks after Kent's disappearance, search planes crisscrossed the area and the local newspapers ran updates. Then the story, along with hope, faded. Only Kent's wife, who experienced disturbing dream visions, believed he was still alive. Perhaps because I had just turned 50, Nickerson tells us, and was about to take early retirement, my children having grown into their own lives, many friends having died, I was standing on the brink of disappearance. I had to know what was there, the terrain, and whether Kent could be called back, whether anyone ever could be called back. Nickerson's haunting book, Disappearance, A Map, is partly an attempt to summon up the dead. It's also an effort to chart her own life, as well as a Baroque compendium of stories about explorers and hikers who've been whited out in the Alaskan wilderness. This is the kind of hard-to-categorize book that runs the risk of becoming lost itself in mega bookstores. A few weeks ago, I was prowling Barnes & Noble's and spotted Phyllis Rose's excellent book on four famous Victorian marriages, Parallel Lives, shelved with the Harlequin romances. Disappearance, A Map, might turn up among the autobiographies or travelogues or even in the New Age spiritual section. I worry that, like the icebound sailing ships Nickerson memorializes, her book will sink beneath a paper blizzard, its distress signals unheard, its precious cargo of wisdom unread. Nickerson served for a time as Alaska's poet laureate, and she writes with shimmering precision about the fatal geography of the far north, the great waves, earthquakes, and deep crevasses that can obliterate life in a second. Not only people have vanished there, but also the native languages and folklore, as well as entire species of now extinct animals. In journal entries styled like an explorer's log, Nickerson gives the longitude and latitude of her own emotional landscape, recording her fears of disappearing into nothingness once she departs from her job and friends and daily routine. The bulk of her narrative, though, is devoted to tales of more renowned adventurers, like Sir John Franklin, who left for the Arctic in 1845 with two ships and 128 men and never returned. For years, teams searched for Franklin's ships as well as for cairns, rock piles in which explorers placed records of their journeys. Franklin's logs were never found, but Nickerson understands the need that propelled his widow, at age 78, to make a voyage to Alaska in one last futile attempt to find them. Without paper trails, all of us face what Nickerson calls the ultimate disappearance of being forgotten. The day after I read Disappearance, A Map, I received a confused note from my favorite aunt, who's now in a nursing home, her memory slipping away. As I read her note, the shaky black words against a snowy expanse of white, I thought about Nickerson's doomed Arctic explorers scratching out their messages, burying them in cairns, and hoping against hope that someone, someday, would discover those papers and rescue the writers from oblivion.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University and contributes to The Nation magazine and The Washington Post. She reviewed Disappearance, A Map, A Meditation on Death and Loss in the High Latitudes by Sheila Nickerson. Coming up, folk singer Ramblin' Jack Elliott. This is Fresh Air. Ramblin' Jack Elliott has made an indelible mark on American folk music for the last 40 years. He traveled and sang with Woody Guthrie in the late 40s and early 50s, taught Bob Dylan a song or two during the Greenwich Folk Revival days of the 1960s, and is credited by singers like Jerry Jeff Walker, Doc Watson, and Joan Baez with having an enormous influence on their careers. Elliott still tours, singing and telling stories in his distinctive folksy rambling style. Last year, Ramblin' Jack Elliott came out with South Coast. It was his first recording in over 20 years. Today, it won a Grammy Award in the traditional folk music category. The album contains a few songs by Elliott's mentor, Woody Guthrie, including this one, Pastures of Plenty.
It's a mighty hard road that my poor hand is hold. My poor feet has traveled a hot, dusty road. Out of your dust bowl and westwards we rolled, and your desert was hot and your mountains was cold. Arizona, California, I'll make all your crops. And it's north up to Oregon to gather your hops. Pick the fruit from your orchard and the grapes from your vines. To set on your table your light sparkling wine. Well, it's always we ramble that river and I. Down along your green valley I will work till I die. And this land I'll defend with my life if it be. Because my pastures of plenty must always be free.
Well, you were not born with the name Ramblin' Jack Elliott. You were born Elliott Charles Adnapose?
Adnapose, yeah.
Well, how did you decide on the name that you use now, Ramblin' Jack Elliott?
Well, it's no mystery. Obviously, the name, as you found, very difficult to pronounce, and so did everyone else. And I was disgusted with listening to teachers in school and everybody else embarrass me with this weird name, which is, I didn't blame them. It is a weird name, and it's natural for everyone to mispronounce it. And it didn't sound American. And I was in love with the whole image of America and the cowboy. So I chose a name for myself that just sounded more like a real natural down-home American cowboy name. The first name I picked was based on my original name, my middle name, Charles. Of course, the nickname for Charles is Chuck, so I used to call myself Chuck Adnipose, and then I got to get rid of that adenoids thing. So I started calling myself Chuck Elliott, and then I went from Chuck to Buck.
Yeah, so how did Buck become Jack?
Well, this was totally by accident. It happened right out here shortly after I met Woody. I came out here helping drive a friend of mine out to Travis Air Force Base, dropped him off at Travis, and came to San Francisco to look around. And I came upon a beautiful schooner and met the owner and her son, and they invited me on board for dinner. I met the son first, and he introduced me to his mother and said, "Mother, this is Jack Elliott." And I was too embarrassed to say, correct them or say, no, that's not right. So I just accepted it right then, and it became Jack. And I thought, that's cool. it's a little bit less limiting, you know.
Tell us how you hooked up with Woody Guthrie, because he at one point said about you, "Jack sounds more like me than I do."
Well, my old friend Tom Paley, who I used to play guitar with, and Tom was the world's greatest guitar player, introduced me to Woody. And I called Woody up one day on the phone and told him I was a friend of Tom's. So he invited me to come over and visit him. It was as simple as that.
Mm. Well, you traveled with Woody Guthrie for, 5 or 6 years?
Yeah, from 51 through 1954. Maybe about 4 years.
So
after that, he went in the hospital and didn't travel anymore.
Right, because he had Huntington's chorea.
Yeah.
What did he teach you about traveling? How to sort of travel the road?
Well, we didn't do any hitchhiking together. He didn't teach me a lot about traveling. He drove the car, but that was when we were driving in a car. We were just living at Woody's house. I lived with the Guthrie family for a whole year in 1951. Arla was 4 years old then. Let's see. Woody showed me how Greyhound bus drivers sit at the steering wheel. I remember Woody wrote a play once when I drove him to Florida in my Model A Ford. The car cost me $25. I bought it in a junkyard.
Hmm.
And it was running. It didn't need any repairs at the time. But by the time we started down to Florida, it started to need a few repairs. And Woody spent about $50 total on the trip going down, with about 4 different breakdowns going down through the Carolinas. So I figured he'd bought the car. So when I left in Florida, I took off hitchhiking and left the car for Woody. I gave him that Model A.
So did you sing with him then all over and in bars and in camps?
Well, we traveled from New York to California in a car one time. But we didn't do any singing in bars then. We hardly ever got out of the car. It was a very fast trip. Billy Fair did most of the driving. Billy's a banjo player from Woodstock, New York. I first met Billy in New Orleans. Wrote a song about it. First song I ever wrote, I think. It was called The 912 Greens. It's a very long kind of narrative travel log about our trip from New York down through the mountains of North Carolina, winding up in New Orleans at a place called 912 Toulouse Street, and trying to get our Seaman's papers and ship out in the Merchant Marine, but we couldn't do it. So I ended up just standing there looking at the river with the line, "Did you ever stand and shiver just because you were looking at a river?"
We ended up in a bar down by the waterfront, with John Truman telling stories about the Merchant Marine and the sea and ships for 3.5 days one night. After that story, Well, we were just going to ship out. Going to ship out around the world. Shipping was kind of slow, though. We went down to the NMU hall. In order to get your seaman's papers, you had to get a letter from a captain to the union, get a letter from the union to the Coast Guard, get a letter from the Coast Guard to you, get a letter from you to the captain. So we said, frigate. That's an old nautical term. We'll build our own ship. Did you ever stand and shiver just because you were looking at a river?
I think it's also in 912 Green's hearing an introduction to that, you make a reference to Jack Kerouac, who was someone that you knew. And he actually read you his entire On the Road book before it was published.
That's right. It was about 3 years before it was published. It was 1953. Book was published in 56. He sat on the floor for 3 days and nights, and we just listened to Jack reading that wonderful narrative of his adventure on the road.
Did he want your advice?
No, no. He's older than me, and he'd done a heap as much traveling or more than I had. Been in the Navy, been in the Merchant Marine, rode freight trains. I've only ridden one freight train, and I don't recommend it. Much as I would have liked to have emulated Woody, who rode a lot of freight trains, more than us all. And they're quite dangerous. I prefer riding on trucks myself.
Well, I would assume dangerous, what, just getting on and off, but also dangerous...
Oh, just merely riding in them is darn scary at best, and I've met a lot of people who love riding on freight trains and have offered to take me riding, and of course there was a very revealing story in yesterday's paper about, out here, Chronicle, about some irresponsible person that had written a romantic article about the fun of riding freight trains. A lot of yuppies, so the story goes, have discovered this freight train riding as being some sort of a pastime for adventure and pleasure. And showed a photograph of some guy trying to start a cooking fire on the floor of a wooden boxcar.
Wow.
And the letters to the editor, there were two very fine, irate, informed letters, one by a man who designs and tests modern freight trains and boxcars and freight train cars. And he talked about the many dangers of even just being around a freight train, like standing near one when it's going by. Mm. You can be cut in half by a loose piece of steel that sticks out from the train. Steel bands that they use to hold logs on, every once in a while one of those bands will break, and it might be sticking out 6 feet sideways from the train. And that's enough to kill a person.
Sure, sure. What are some of the memories you have of those early folky days? And this is, you know, the early days of Bob Dylan and Joan Baez and others who were performing in Greenwich Village. What do you remember from those days?
I remember that there was a great atmosphere of excitement and joy in the atmosphere, and people might not have been aware of the fact that these people were headed for stardom or anything like that. It was just a great kind of passionate joy and enjoyment of the life of what was going on right there in those smoke-filled rooms. Mm-hmm. In those coffee houses where people were singing these songs, and in Greenwich Village. And I sang in Greenwich Village with great enjoyment during that period and on through for the next 10 years or so until it faded and died, and I haven't been back to play in New York City in about 10 years now. Some of those same nightclubs that were once fun to be in, I just somehow seem like they lost it.
But you were able to find enough work traveling and performing around the country?
Yes, I have never had to take a job.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm curious, too, with having such a life on the road, whether it was ever hard to get, for instance, royalty checks to you, or whether there were just times when record companies couldn't find you in order to pay you.
That's true. I know they've been searching high and low, and I apologize to them.
Well, in a sense, isn't that your problem, right? I mean, don't you?
Yeah, well, I don't think they're worried about it, as a matter of fact.
Ramblin' Jack Elliott just won a Grammy in the traditional folk music category. This is Fresh Air. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has found a record he says he'd almost rather play than talk about. It's volume one in a series called Keyboard Wizards of the Gershwin Era and features selections by a pianist named Pauline Alpert. Here's Lloyd's review.
One of my favorite street corners in 20th century music is the intersection of high art and pop culture, as in the music of George Gershwin, especially Gershwin playing his own complex arrangements of his tunes. Record producer Artis Woodhouse had a big hit a couple of years ago with a recording of Gershwin piano rolls, and last year she produced a second album with Gershwin playing pop tunes by other composers. Her latest project is a series that features other pianists of the period, musicians whose names, Zez Confrey, Billy Mayerl, Roy Bargy, Frank Banta, are not as familiar as Gershwin, though Bargy made a famous recording of Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. For want of a better term, or maybe a worse, they're known as novelty pianists, because of the wit and playfulness of their arrangements. No one could make these complicated riffs sound so effortless without considerable classical training. And although what they play is as carefully written out as a Beethoven sonata, the jazz influence makes everything sound as if it's being improvised on the spot. The first album in the new series is devoted to recordings made some 50 years ago by Pauline Alpert, the first lady of the keyboard.
Thank you.
That was The Glowworm, that old chestnut written by Paul Link around 1920. You might remember from I Love Lucy reruns that it's the only tune Lucy Ricardo can still remember, barely, from her high school saxophone lessons. She certainly couldn't keep up with Pauline Alpert's teasing syncopations. There are 27 selections on the disc, and they originate from a wide variety of sources. There are show tunes by Gershwin, Rodgers and Hart, Vincent Humans, Harold Arlen, and Irving Berlin. And songs from the movies, ranging from Whistle While You Work to The Continental. There are standards like Sweet Sue, which turned up on another Lucy episode, patriotic medleys, and novelty numbers like Raymond Scott's Toy Trumpet. Some of my favorites are Alpert's arrangements of classical or semi-classical pieces, like Rimsky-Korsakov's Song of India, which includes a quotation from Scheherazade, and Liszt's Second Hungarian Rhapsody. The exotic nature of these arrangements has a lot in common with film scoring. In some way, the limitation of these selections is that although the technical virtuosity is full of surprises, down to deliberately missed notes, the pieces all sound essentially the same. Yet the jokes are funny, and the underlying rhythmic drive is irresistible. The hardest part about doing this review is choosing which of the 27 pieces on the album I want you to hear most. I want to hear all of them, and that's why I keep listening to this album over and over. Addictions, after all, don't come from a desire for change, but from a need to keep repeating one's pleasures.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and director of the Creative Writing Program at the University of Massachusetts Boston. He reviewed Volume 1 of Keyboard Wizards of the Gershwin Era, featuring pianist Pauline Alpert, on the Pearl label. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Chris Fraley was today's engineer. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our intern is Nate Hardy. For Terry Gross, I'm Artie Moss-Cohen.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.